Hey, welcome to the Medical Stuff. My name is Mark Frankham, and that big pig-sticking bastard over there is...
Chris Finkston.
That's all you got?
What?
That's all you got?
That's all I got.
That's all you got.
How do I top an intro like that?
Quite frankly, Mark,
I'm surprised I have to introduce myself the way I carry this show.
Yeah. So today we're on our third podcast. We're getting ready to rock it into there. Today we're going to be talking about something else entirely different. We're actually going to be doing kind of a potpourri where we talk about different technologies and different techniques and things we do in medicine, specifically pre-hospital medicine, so that people can get a better grasp of why they need these things. We're going to go over some topics today like spine boards, cardiac monitors, what they do, why we do that.
How they're portrayed in the media incorrectly.
Exactly. And IVs, what they're good for, and then some of the different medications we carry, and then anything else that pops into our tiny brains.
We're also going to touch a little bit on Narcan today. It's been in the news a little bit, Naloxone.
Yes, it's been in the news a lot, actually. So, yeah. Watched a video just the other day of two people in a car passed out high on heroin.
Yeah.
And they end up having to give rescue breaths and Narcan, the girlfriend does, to the guy while she's sitting on top of him in the car.
Yeah, I saw the same video, which what cracks me up about the video is there's someone just filming with a cell phone.
Right.
Outside.
Yeah. Hey, man, you need to get up and get out of here.
Right.
Call 911. And there was never a paramedic on that scene.
No, there wasn't.
Even the cop just reached in and shook him a bit.
Right. Well, you know, it's the shake and wake.
Right. Yeah. And I did appreciate the fact that he puked on his shoes.
Yeah, that's a common side effect of that medication, though. We actually had a call recently, but we'll get there when we get there. So first up is spine boards.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about spine boards
or short spine boards.
Yeah, there's several different types. So spine boards, basically, it's an immobilization device. It's commonly used when there's been a significant enough mechanism or we have reason to suspect that there could be trauma to the spine that we need to immobilize the patient's spine so it doesn't move.
It's a splint for the spine.
Exactly.
It's just no different than splinting your arm if you break it. If we feel you've done something to break your back, then you're going to be put on a spine board.
Yeah. And we used to throw people on these things willy-nilly.
Oh, just because we were there.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, even if we were just bored. And they've actually been using them a little bit less and less. But the reason they used to be used is still valid. The medicine behind it's valid. So your spine's important. And whenever you have a break in that bony structure, you've got a lot of sharp edges near a very sensitive wire that runs through your body and allows you to move, allows you to do everything from breathing to taking a crap to walking. And we want to protect that. So the idea is to keep it stabilized.
Right. No, I was just thinking you should only do two of those at one time.
Two what? Crapping and walking.
So, breathe and crap, breathe and walk.
Yeah.
Don't crap and walk.
Right. Yeah, that's the one that you probably should do. Yeah, don't crap and walk, but not breathe.
Don't prove your intelligence by crapping and walking at the same time. Chew gum and walk at the same time. Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to say this. A lot of people out there always talk about, God, I wish there were less idiots in the world.
Right.
Please stop wishing that. That's my job security. Exactly. I bank on at least a few morons every day.
So anyway, yeah, log spine board. What we do is we take inline manual stabilization. We get you into a natural position, which is generally on your back with your face laying up, and we will move you to the spine board as one. So we're never going to just like twist your head or your body without you want to move it as one piece so that you can splint it onto the spine board.
Manual stabilization, by the way, is a fancy way of saying we're going to hold your head still.
Right. So keep you from moving around.
Yeah, because the big thing we want to protect is the cervical spine, which is your neck. Because the higher up the spine you go, the more critical functions the spinal cord plays a role in. So if you have a high level severing, that's where your breathing stops.
Right.
And it doesn't take a genius to figure out that no breathing is bad.
Right.
So we try and prevent that at all costs. So what we'll do is we'll arrive on scene, like Mark said, it's manual stabilization. We usually apply a collar right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
This collar, typically, I think I probably get more complaints about the collar than I do the board.
Yeah, in the short term. The collars, I mean, they try and make them conform to everybody, but they're just not comfortable.
Yeah, and...
And they have to be fairly tight.
Yeah, and so the collar's there to keep the neck from moving. And like Mark said... Oh, go ahead.
Now, as a difference, these are not the foam collars that you can get from a local pharmacist store.
Right.
These are a hard plastic contoured
collar
that go around your neck and hold your neck in place. Is better than probably nothing, but...
Yeah.
They tend to jab into you, and they poke into you, and they're held together by Velcro, and they're made one size fits most, and so,
yeah,
they're not going to be a perfect fit.
Yeah, actually, Mark used to have a good saying about this. the collar, it's rigid, but it won't keep your neck in place. Your neck is stronger than the collar.
Right.
It's there to remind you.
And it won't choke you. It's actually made to leave your airway open.
Yes, I hear that all the time. It's choking me. Well, if you're talking
to me, yeah, then you're not choking. Yeah.
So we apply it. Then what we do is, like Mark said, we log roll you. That's where we roll you as a unit. And we'll check your back, and then we slide a board underneath there, and we roll you back onto the board, and we secure you down to the board.
As Chris said, for many years, this is what we did to everybody.
Yeah.
So, for many years, this was a standard for any sort of trauma.
Absolutely.
Fall patient, minor MVA. It was way overused.
Yes.
I remember when I first started, if you went to a car wreck where the patient had gotten themselves out of their car and were sitting in another car, because they had been in a car wreck, you still had to spine board them, even though they'd been up walking around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, and they still actually train this today, but I remember it used to be in the skill station when you're going through training and you're doing longboard immobilization. And, well, this is what I remember. Maybe this was just my school, and you have more experience with this, but when you were doing the training, you had to do the test, your scenario could potentially be a standing takedown.
Yeah.
And standing takedowns, just, you know, for anyone who hasn't figured that out, that's when someone's up and standing and walking around, and you've now determined they need to be on a spine board.
It's trust falling with a board behind you.
Exactly. And your station could potentially be a standing takedown. That was really heavily taught. Especially recently, I've done standing takedowns in the field, but especially recently, it's been a long time.
Well, the thing with the changes that we'll talk about, what we find is that if you're willing to do a standing takedown, then we're just not going to use a spine board.
Right. Exactly. You
know? So, like I said, many, many years, decades this went on. Well, finally, somebody did a study.
Yep.
And they found out that these are actually causing more harm than good when they're overused. There are definitely situations where they're very valuable.
Perfect.
And they, you know, they will save lives and they will save limbs.
Yeah.
But what they were finding was, is because it's a hard plastic board, that as you lay on it, it creates pressure points at an accelerated rate.
Yes, it does.
And so within 45 minutes, especially in the elderly population, it would start causing decubitus breakdowns, which are bed sores to a lot of people.
And I think a lot of people underestimate the damage that a decubitus breakdown or that a bed sore can do. They're an open invitation for massive infection. And in our elderly population, which, by the way, our elderly population, they fall a lot. Mm-hmm. And so we see them as trauma patients very frequently. So they did end up on a lot of backboards. And this causes these decubitus ulcers on their skin. They're also very prone to infection at that age, especially if they already spend a lot of time in bed anyway. Right. And so we were really impacting the quality of life for patients.
Well, yeah, if it goes unnoticed and continues to be infected because it's under the skin. So it could just be, oh, I'm not feeling well, or I pulled a muscle. And right. Then by the time it gets to the point where it's realized, its possibility has gotten down and started breaking down bone matter. And getting in and fixing that is an extremely long, difficult process.
Oh, yeah. And it's expensive.
Right. Absolutely. This is multiple doctor visits. This is probably a nursing home stay. Because if it's, depending on where it is in your body, you may not be able to sit up. You may have to lay down constantly, but then you have to worry about other decubitus ulcers.
Right. And there are some devices that have been invented, as well as different backboards that are out there that increase or that decrease these chances. I would say the first one that personally I feel is ridiculous, but is contoured plastic backboards. So there's a few of them out there that have a contour to them. Well, that's fantastic if that happens to be the contour of your back.
Again, this is, you know, one size fits most.
Right, exactly.
But if you don't, you're actually going to increase that decubitus ulcer point.
Absolutely. And then the second thing that, I mean, there's probably more than just the two that are off the top of my head, but one of the ones that we use in our agency is called the back wrapped, and that one's had some good positive studies behind it, but it's still, you're still on a hard backboard. What the back wrapped is it's essentially a pool toy, floaty.
Yeah, it's an inflatable piece that goes between the patient and the board.
Yeah, and it's just a little air mattress that provides some cushion, and that does help, but it only does pretty much from the hips up, and so you still have the sacrum. Or
the heels.
Yeah.
The back of the legs.
Those are all still in contact. So those help. So what they've started to do now, though, is they've started to adjust protocols in accordance with these studies and these findings to where we're using backboards less. In our agency, the county we work in, we are now using flat gurneys on a flat gurney mattress as a form of spinal stabilization, because that flat gurney is going to contour a lot better. You're still going to be able to effectively immobilize your patient to prevent twisting, moving, and that kind of things. But at the same time, you're going to reduce the risk of those decubitus ulcers.
And also, we've gotten more liberal protocols in the fact that we just don't have to put people on boards.
Right.
If they're going to rest, they found that if you're just going to rest quietly on the gurney, that's going to do as much good as being immobilized to something. As long as the patient's not thrashing around.
Yeah.
You know, but now again, like I said, there are times when spine boards are extremely useful.
Certainly.
And there has to be that mechanism to make that a useful piece of equipment.
And one of the things to consider too is sometimes the spine board is really good for moving someone, just plain moving somebody.
Yeah.
Even if it's a spinal injured patient. So if I'm looking and I've got a substantial mechanism and I'm thinking, you know, maybe this person would benefit from just being on a flat gurney, but getting them from the car to that flat gurney is going to be really hard to keep their spine stable. That's a good time for a board.
Right.
Because you got to move them to that gurney in the first place.
Or a scoop stretcher.
Scoop stretchers are fantastic.
I've used a scoop stretcher before to be a spinal mobilization device.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great in the right circumstance.
Yeah, so a scoop stretcher is basically a stretcher that comes in two halves. And it you connect it at the head, and then they kind of looks like a scissor mechanism.
It's kind of like a Twix. You have a left scoop and a right scoop.
Are you a left or a right guy?
I'm a right guy.
Ah, gotcha.
But yeah, it splits in half, and then you don't have to. It minimizes the amount you have to move the patient to get them on a device that they can be picked up on. And then the nice thing I like about a scoop is when you get to the hospital, you don't have to be rolled at all to get the patient off of it.
No, you don't.
So a patient who has a hip fracture or something like that, amazing piece of equipment.
Yeah. So yeah.
Spine boards, great in the right circumstance, but way overused for many, many decades.
Yeah. I think spine boards, I think overall, they're going to stick around for a while. And I think we're ever going to see them go away.
I mean, we all know that in EMS that people find new and inventive ways in which to help themselves hurt themselves every single day.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. You know, it keeps my job really interesting.
Roof over your head, your food in your family's belly.
Yeah. You tried to use roller skates to put up Christmas lights. Sir, explain to me the logic.
My favorite was the Christmas light standing on the trash can that has two wheels on it.
That was Was that you and I?
That may have been.
Yeah, on the back of a brick house, right?
Yeah.
Yep. That was him. Yeah.
It was right after I bought the flowers in that pumpkin.
Yeah.
And they were sitting in between the front seats of the ambulance. I bought them for my girlfriend at the time. And I remember that the...
It's a spam caller at that, too. Like, isn't that...
I turned my phone down. Some of us are professionals. But anyway, we get there, we're leaving, we're going code 3, the guy's extremely injured, he was on a spine board, and the wife climbs in, she sees the flowers, and she goes, "Oh, those are pretty flowers," and then she looks at me, and she stops, she goes, "Why would I say that right now?"
No, I remember that, yeah.
I said, "Well, they are pretty flowers." So,
and actually, I believe the guy was, he was climbing a ladder, and he had to reach, and then he put one foot on the trash can with wheels, and then it kicked out. Yeah, I remember that. He was
fairly well injured.
Yeah, he was hurt.
Yeah,
we made him an injury.
He had a closed head injury. So, okay, that's spine boards. Definitely look them up. You can see the different ones. I remember I started in Oklahoma. It was literally a piece of plexiglass or plastic bolted to a metal frame.
Yeah, wow.
And they would brand our company's name in them so we could identify them as ours. And then the doctors were complaining because the brands would show up on the x-rays. Which my response during the meeting was, well, can we just tell the doctors that, you know, if the fracture spells the word EMSA, that maybe it's not a fracture.
Right, yeah, that's, there you go.
If it makes letters, maybe it's not what you think it is.
You know what I'd say? Also put the phone number down there. Just be like, for return ride, exactly. Call.
We're losing a marketing ploy right here.
Wow, I think this is good. So, so let's talk about cardiac monitors. So okay. There's a bit
cardiac
of a switch.
Monitors, a heart beady, beady, thumpy thing.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you the thing. I like the cardiac monitor because, not that my job needs more legitimacy, but nothing quite spells legit medical professional like applying a monitor and looking at your heart.
Right.
And knowing what's on the screen.
Right. That's the important part at the end there.
And I will tell you this, because there is a lot of people... Right. Yeah. Knowing what you're looking at. There's a lot of people out there that I just don't think understand exactly what we do.
Absolutely.
And it's one of the reasons I like doing this show.
Right.
And I also think there's also kind of a group of people that call us and they expect us just, okay, come on in, put me on the gurney, take me to the hospital.
Right.
And then the monitor is kind of one of the things that, to me, I noticed that the moment you set that monitor down, you're like, hey, I just want to take a quick look at your heart, see what's going on.
It's a piece of equipment that legitimizes you.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, it changes their perspective on a paramedic from, you know, ambulance jockey to, oh, snap.
Right. Maybe this person's not a Warren he looks like he is.
I'll actually talk to him. Right. You know, yeah. I'll actually tell him what's going on today.
So, a cardiac monitor can do more than just look at cardiac rhythms these days. There was a time when that's all it did. When I started, yes. Yep. You could look at a heart rhythm.
You had a very basic view of right. the heart.
You could look at the heart. You can take a patient's pulse. You can take a blood pressure. You mm-hmm. can check the amount of CO2 that they're exhaling.
And check the amount of oxygen that's going through their blood.
Exactly. You can shock a patient like you see on TV when they do it incorrectly.
Yeah, right.
You can also do what's called transcutaneous pacing.
Right.
So we'll go into all of these things a little more in depth here in just a second. But the cardiac monitor, I mean, it's a really becoming an invaluable piece of equipment. At one point, it was kind of an add-on. And now, I mean, we really couldn't do the job we do without it.
Well, and by the time I came into the field, the cardiac monitor was pretty much what you're describing now. I mean, it's a little bit better in the sense that one of the features I didn't have was now we can wirelessly transmit your EKG to a receiving hospital. And that was something that happened as I was in the field. But for the most part, by the time I got in, these things were doing full-on 12-lead EKGs. They were defibrillating and pacing and all the fancies.
Right.
You know, but you're so from a time when, you know...
Mark, rub two sticks together. Take man to hospital. No, that was your dad.
Yeah,
right. So, 3-lead. You said 12-lead there. So, our cardiac monitors can do 3-lead monitoring, and they can do 12-lead.
Yeah.
So, a 3-lead is 3 cables or 4 cables, mm-hmm. and they can look at your heart one angle at a time from 3 different angles. And this is a monitoring mode. This is what we're going to look at while we're taking you to the hospital.
The best way to think about these leads that I've ever found is think of them as just like cameras. You have a 3-lead and then you have a 12-lead. What a 12-lead means is you basically have 3 different angles that you're looking at the heart from.
The 3-lead.
Yeah, different sides. So in the 3-lead, you've got 3.
Right.
And then there are others to get a little more complicated. You have the MCLs, the modified chest leads.
Don't. You're getting too technical, Chris. You know I get confused.
Well, so basically what you're looking at is a graph between amplitude and time.
So on the 3-lead monitor, like you said, you're looking at the potentially from 1-lead at a time from 3 different angles. And you can tell if the heart's beating normally, abnormally, or not at all.
Too fast, too slow, or too bad.
Right.
Yeah.
12-lead monitoring, on the other hand, is a diagnostic tool.
Right.
Where you look at 12 different angles at one time.
And that's going to help us determine if you're having the classic heart attack, or we call the myocardial infarction. This basically means a lack of blood supply to an area of the heart. And that's really why we need all those views, is we're trying to figure out, because if you're having a heart attack in a certain area of the heart, it may not show up in just those 3 leads. In fact, it would be very difficult to diagnose many heart attacks with just those 3 leads. But if we have all 12 leads, we can look at all sides of the heart, and we're better able to determine if you're having a heart attack by viewing those leads.
Yes, exactly. And so, because there are times when you're having that heart attack, and we don't want to give you our medication because it's the area of the heart that your heart is infarcting or dying, you'll have a negative outcome. It can drop out the patient's blood pressure.
Yeah, this changes our treatment.
So, and like Chris was saying, now we can actually, with Bluetooth and cellular technology, we will transmit that 12-lead, if they're having a heart attack, to the receiving hospital, so that the doctor at the hospital, the cardiologist, has an idea of what they're getting, not just the fact the person's having a heart attack, but where it is, what's going on, and it cuts down what's called the door to catheterization time.
Yeah, catheterization is basically where they put a balloon in your heart, and basically they open up the pathways that have been clogged with a clot.
Right. And so the statement about heart attacks always is time is muscle.
Yes.
The longer it takes to get that artery open back up, the more damage you're doing.
Right.
And so anything we can do to decrease that time is a boon for the patient.
Absolutely. And it's had a lot of positive effects on patients.
Oh, yeah.
The other things we'll look at, and these Mark had mentioned the rhythms that we look at earlier. So some of these rhythms, so for example, the heart attack, while not necessarily a rhythm, but there are certain key indicators in the EKG that tell us that you're having a heart attack. We're going to treat that oftentimes with medicine. We'll give aspirin. Which is very common. It's actually an antiplatelet aggregator. It basically keeps your platelets from sticking together. We'll give nitroglycerin, which dilates blood vessels that will help blood flow get around clots. But there are other things that we're going to treat, certain rhythms that we might treat with electricity. Basically, that's the shocking or the defibrillation that you see. So there are certain rhythms. I think the most classic we'll talk about is ventricular fibrillation.
Mm-hmm.
Ventricular fibrillation is basically a useless wiggle that the heart does before it dies.
Imagine a heart mold made of jello.
Exactly.
And it's just quivering.
Yeah. And so instead of having these nice squeezes where it's squeezing blood out, this quiver does nothing. You won't have a pulse. The patient's dead. By all intents and purposes, this patient is dead. And that is where we will do the classic defibrillation. Go for it, Mark. You want to.
This drives me crazy every single time I see it on TV.
And it drives every paramedic crazy.
Every medical professional probably. We Seriously. Do not shock flatline.
No, we don't.
Because we're not jump starting the heart when we do this. What we're actually trying to do would be probably closer akin to Control-Alt-Delete on a computer.
Yeah, shut
we're
it off.
We're actually stopping the heart, so we're shocking it to flatline. Then, with CPR and medications, we hope to restart the heart.
Yeah, because what's happening in that fibrillation is all the individual heart cells, that wiggle, all the individual heart cells are marching to the beat of their own drum. They're all firing individually. And basically what we're doing is we're, with electricity, we're grabbing that heart, saying, knock it off, and squeezing it one big time, and then letting go.
Yeah.
And then hopefully they all get on the same page again.
Right. Now we have two different types of defibrillation. One is called defibrillation. One is called synchronized cardioversion.
Yep.
Now, they're both using electricity to shock the heart.
But different rhythms.
Different rhythms and different ways of going about it. With defibrillation, you just do it now.
Yeah.
Do as fast as possible and hit it hard.
And dump a lot.
Yeah. Yep. And with synchronized cardioversion, you're actually trying to time it so it defibrillates at the proper time. Because you don't want to cause them to go into heart attack. You just want to slow the heart down.
Right.
So these patients may be conscious. You know, we may have sedated them. They're generally deteriorating, so we have to do something now, or they will go into a rhythm that's going to be non-compatible with life.
And by the way, this is unpleasant to get. Okay. Yeah, to get cardioverted conscious is unpleasant. It doesn't happen often, but I could probably count on one hand the times I've done it over the past 12 years. And that's crazy. It's been 12 years.
I know.
Anyway, yeah, over the past 12 years, I could count on one hand the times I've done it to a conscious patient. And every time, even with sedation, we give a little bit of pre-medicine. We give a medicine called Versed, which will, hopefully help you through this.
Well, it'll sedate you. Plus, it also has an effect of making you forget.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, in the then and now, certainly aware.
Yes.
Certainly aware when you hit them with that.
Oh, yeah.
And
we did it to one lady, and she woke up. Because we didn't have, she was deteriorating quickly. We didn't have time to drop the Versed. So as I was drawing it up, my partner shocked her. And
Gotta
she
do it.
Came up pissed.
Yeah.
I mean, 89-year-old female, and she's cussing us.
Oh, we had this lady. Of course, everyone's got the few. Everyone has a few conscious cardioversion stories because they stick out.
Right.
And everyone's got one if they've done it long enough. And I remember this lady because it was right around the time that the docs were really wanting us to get on top of giving amiodarone. Amiodarone is a medication we give to help get rid of certain rhythms. One of those rhythms is ventricular tachycardia, and that's also one that we cardiovert. And so I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to go drop this amiodarone. And the way the apartment was structured, I couldn't get to the patient. I was basically at the back of a crowd of paramedics. Everyone seemed like they were doing a good job from where I was, so I didn't need to intervene. So I'll get the amiodarone because I'm closest. And started getting it drawn up, and then I turned around just in time to hear, clear! And so I'm like, well.
Well, I'm not going to need the amiodarone more than likely.
Things just took a turn.
Right.
And that happened, and she came up mad, and then she just kind of showed, like, I understand the initial mad of, the hell'd you do?
Right.
But then she came up, and she's like, I want a blanket. Don't let my cats out. Make sure you lock up the door. Is the stove on? You're not have dirty shoes. That was the thing I actually said about me. I was like, are you guys' shoes dirty?
Yeah. Well, and I remember, that's the important thing, right?
Well,
now,
and here's the thing. Her carpet, by the way, look like a convenience store parking lot. This was not a high standard of cleanliness. And I remember just thinking, I'm like, wow, we just literally saved your life.
Right.
Literally. Very literally. Because it's not often that we actually stop someone from dying right then and there.
Right.
But it does happen. And we just did it. And for all she cares, her cats are fed and her carpet's clean. Right. You know, it's just like, okay. Well,
to me, that shows you've done a good job.
Yeah.
If they're worried about their cats and their carpet,
yeah,
then we've definitely done something right.
Society hasn't, but, you know, no, I'm joking.
So, that's, again, you're shocking the heart to stop it, to bring it back at a rhythm that's more compatible with life.
Yeah.
And so, anytime you see anybody shock flatline on TV, do Chris and I a solid and yell out, wherever you are, movie theater, I don't care. That's not how you use electricity in a cardiac rhythm.
Absolutely. That's not ventricular fibrillation. People think you're really cool if you do it, too. So, keeping on the subject of electricity, though, I think, Mark, you touched on transcutaneous pacing.
Yes.
Earlier. So transcutaneous is a fancy word for through the skin.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to pace people sometimes. So a lot of people are familiar with a pacemaker. I don't think there's a whole lot of people out there that haven't heard of the term, but basically this is the same thing.
Except the one that goes in your chest, not the car in the NASCAR races that makes sure they're all going the same speed.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know.
That's a different type of pacemaker.
Yeah, and it would get you really confused in this conversation.
And it's also not the company of Ford who was a pacer maker.
Oh, really?
Because they did make the pacer cars.
Oh, very true.
I remember those. Look like gremlins.
Oh, yeah. That's old.
Digging to, your dad knows about those.
Yeah, no, I know. Old people know about those. Got it. So, no, I'm joking. So, right. So the other thing we'll do is transcutaneous pacing. So sometimes the heart is beating too slow, or it's not beating fast enough or effectively. And so what we'll do is we'll apply the pads. They're the same pads you use to defib, at least on our unit it is. There are units out there, cardiac monitors out there, where you have a set of defib pads and you have a set of pacer pads.
Yeah, that's how it was for many years because the companies swore up and down you could not combine the two into one.
Yeah, and then someone's like, hey, yeah, you can.
I did.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with your heart beating too slow is that in and of itself, certain people have slow heartbeats.
Right.
Professional bicyclists or sports people will have a very low resting heart rate in the 30s. So, I mean, that's not a problem. But the problem is that for most of us to have heart rate in the 30s, there's also a commensurate drop in your blood pressure.
Yes.
So that's where we run into problems.
Yeah.
Because if you don't get enough blood to your brain, you're going to pass out.
Yeah. Or die.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we do is we pace, and basically what this does is it just applies a little bit of electricity to the heart, and it causes it to contract.
And what would be that unit of amperage?
It's milliamps.
There you go.
Yeah.
Ooh, see, I didn't think you knew that.
Wow, have faith.
Well, to compare that to when we're cardioverting or defibrillating, we're using joules.
Right.
And we're using 150 to 360 joules.
Yes.
Depending on the situation. There are some that are outside that joule setting. But it's a fairly large amount of... A large enough amount of electricity when you're cardioverting or defibrillating, you need to make sure there's not an excessive amount of water on the chest because it'll arc across the chest through the chest hair. And you have to be very careful with that. So, milliamps, it's literally just a very small amount of electricity through the heart to try and get it to beat at a rate that brings your blood pressure up.
Yeah.
Now, are there other ways to bring up a blood pressure? Sure.
Sure.
But that involves starting an IV.
And we're not very good at that.
No.
No, I'm joking. We're actually really good at that.
I'm so mad at myself today.
Did you miss one?
No, I got it.
Sorry, did you miss another?
No.
Sorry.
No, I did get the IV and accidentally pulled it out while I was trying to secure it.
Oh, son of... No, that's...
That's frustrating.
That is the most disheartening thing, especially if it's a hard stick, and
It was a hard stick on a critical patient.
Oh.
Yeah, that had, you know, been down for a couple of days.
I like how we're laughing about this, by the way. It's like,
we're not laughing about the patient's condition. We're laughing about my stupidity
of
pulling that IV when now I was able to get another one.
Good.
So, ultimately, everything worked out. But I was not happy with myself, I have to say.
So, I count that as two successes on a hard patient. Fist bump, buddy.
Oh, yeah. I'm rocking it here.
Yeah. No, that's... So, good job.
So, why would we start an IV, Chris?
If we can, and if it's necessary. A big reason we're going to start an IV is going to be medication administration or the potential to need to administer a medication.
Right.
And these medications, when I say medication, that's a broad topic. So that can be anything from a drug like adenosine or atropine or amiodarone.
Or just fluid.
or just fluid. Exactly. It can range to fluid. And sometimes we just need to get people just saline.
Right.
And what that does is that increases the volume of fluid in the vasculature. And that's going to help correct typically a low blood pressure. Is why we're going to give that. The low blood pressure could be there for a number of reasons. It could be a form of shock where we have someone who's bleeding out, either internally or externally. It could be...
Well, the patient we had today had been down for a number of days.
Yeah. Could be sepsis. Could be an infection driving this.
Could be that the heart isn't beating effectively.
Absolutely.
And it's not a heart attack or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, there's something else going on there.
Yeah. So fluid... Very, very commonly given. Or just plain old dehydration.
Yeah.
Yeah, plain old dehydration.
You know, it's the first really hot weekend of the summer.
Which we just had.
And you decided to go out and compete in a tennis tournament.
We ran or drink heavily and not drink water. Because I will tell you, that's the call I ran 3 times in a row.
Same person?
No, not the same person. But all with station one. Or all with
same fire station.
Yeah, all with the same fire station. And it actually got to the point where I look forward to seeing him on scene.
Right.
You know, because like, hey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I get this guy's intoxicated.
Right.
And needs to go to the hospital because he's out in the sun. Okay, cool. We're going to take him to the same one. And all these are happening right around one of the local hospitals at the station's
very
near.
Close to.
Yeah.
So as excited as you are to see the fire department, the hospital is the inverse amount of excited to see you every time you bring in another
patient
like this.
They laughed. By the third one we brought in, they were dying. They're like, really? And then the nurse comes in and she's in there and she goes, so let me guess, intoxicated and outside. I'm like, ding, ding,
yep,
ding, ding,
that's
ding.
The call of the day.
And she's like, well, good, because we're just about to discharge the first one you brought in. The second one's going to be, the second one actually ended up having burns on his feet.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You got to be careful.
Yeah.
So it was hot enough this last weekend in Phoenix. That it was melting like the plastic mailbox holders and trash can lids. So like the big dumpsters with the black lid, it was melting the dumpster lids off the off there. So if it's doing that to plastic, pavement and tarmac, you can get burns from just by touching it.
Yeah, that is an issue. I think the best one, I mean, we're going a little bit of tangent here, but it's a good story to mention. There was a story out of Vegas where they actually had a patient come up to an ambulance and start assaulting one of the paramedics. The other paramedic, apparently was substantially large, said, not today, and put this guy on his face. Guy got pretty decent burns on his hands and face and ended up having to go to a burn center.
Right.
The reason I know the story is because he ended up at a burn center here in Portland.
Oh,
the
wow.
The patient did. And so that's
I mean, and you're protecting your partner. You do what you have to do to protect yourself.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Everybody goes home at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, nothing on the medic.
We don't want to hurt the patient, but we're also not going to allow them to hurt our partner.
No, heck no. So yeah, and the way they were parked, they weren't able to just drive off. So they did what they did. But yeah, but no, hot pavement's
a problem.
I have
cooked eggs on pavement in the summertime.
Cook your skin.
Mm-hmm. So, but you know, yeah, we can give different medications. We can hang, sometimes we'll put medications into a bag of normal saline and run it in at a prescribed rate. So they get so much over a long period of time.
Yep.
You know.
We use pumps now.
Yeah.
Automated pumps.
So an IV, what is it? Well, it's the Roman numeral 4, first of all.
Yeah. Which is actually funny because we do outlines. I think like a lot of people do a little bit of prep. And every time you type in IV, it autocorrects to 4.
Right.
Yeah. In the program we
were using. So I gave up and I just left the title of this section as 4s.
Yeah. It just says 4s now. That's
So there are different size IVs used for different reasons. Like a shotgun.
Yeah.
Smaller the number, the bigger the gauge.
Yep.
And so usually the smallest one you're going to see is a 24 IV, unless you're getting into butterfly needles, which are very, very tiny.
Yeah, we have, I think 25s is the smallest we carry.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's a butterfly needle.
Yeah.
So you have 24, and they go up, or they go down a number by 2. So you have a 24, a 22, a 20, 18, all the way down to 14 we use for IVs.
And a butterfly needle, by the way, those are the ones you typically see that are just purely for blood draw.
Right.
That's it. We're not administering a lot of medication.
They're
we're not
a long term, because there's no, the IV catheters that we use and everybody else uses for actual IVs, what it is it's a metal needle.
Yeah, good.
It's a metal.
Perhaps not. Hang on, let me go and pause really quick.
That's gotta get off my head. Go. So there is a hollow metal needle that has a plastic sheath around it. Now, what we do is we take the IV, we line it up with your vein. And this thing is sharp. Like, surgical level sharp. Right? On the back half of this, you have what's called a flash chamber. So what you do is you take the needle, you line up with the vein, and then if you pick the right angle and you go at the right time, you'll actually stick the needle into the vein, which will cause blood to flow back up that needle and into the flash chamber, and that's how you know you're in.
Yeah.
At that point, you then slide the sheath forward to take the needle out.
Yeah.
Leaving behind the plastic sheath.
Yeah.
Then, at that point, you can take the needle away and throw it away in a sharps container. And you hook up an IV line or a lock, and you now have direct access into the vein. So, with that, you can then give fluids through that, as we were talking about earlier, fluid challenges.
Yeah. Medications.
And the medications. But you have to be very careful because this can be a leading cause of phlebitis, which is an infection of the blood.
Yeah, and you have to be careful. I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense, where it's a direct access to the bloodstream. So there's a very sterile and clean process. Well, not sterile, I believe medically clean is the technical term, isn't mm-hmm. it? Yeah. Clean process that we use to put it in. That involves prepping the site with either iodine or alcohol or sometimes both.
Right. You got to be careful with iodine because so many people are allergic to it.
Absolutely.
But it depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and
iodine. You may not really use it on an IV, but if they're doing like a central line, they're going to do that because that is more of a surgical technique as opposed to medically clean. Now, in the environment we work in where we start IVs, sterility is really almost unattainable, if not unattainable at all, just because we're outside, we're in the back of a vehicle. Our vehicles are kept clean. We clean them after every call. But you know what? We're sitting on top of a diesel engine that's putting out exhaust.
Mm-hmm.
The doors are open. People are in and out of the back of the rig.
We've had sick patients in and out of the back of the rig.
Right. You know, so, I mean, there's always going to be... sterility is not... This is not an operating room.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be careful. We can push medications through there. All sorts of medications. And when you give a medication IV... It doesn't have to be absorbed. It doesn't have to be digested. It goes straight into the bloodstream. So what can be some of the medications that we're going to be given through there?
There's a host of medications for just about anything. There's a host of medications for just about anything. There's epinephrine, which is commonly given for everything from allergic reactions for treatment in what we'd call a code 99, which is no heart rate, no respiratory rate.
So, yes, we're going to talk about different classifications of drugs. On right. these, we have, like, antidysrhythmics.
Pressors.
Pressors. Antidysrhythmics are being used if your heart is having a dysrhythmia, which is an odd beat.
Like that ventricular tachycardia we spoke of earlier.
Right, and we could give amiodarone or lidocaine to that.
Yeah.
You know.
Pressors is another class. And in a pressor, that's going to cause vascular constriction, where it's going to have your vasculature, such as your veins and arteries, are going to get smaller. That's going to help increase blood pressure.
Right.
And those are situations where we would want to increase your blood pressure is going to be, well, where your blood pressure is too low, specifically would be like V-code 99,
right.
where you have no blood pressure, or someone who's substantially hypotensive, forms of shock, we might be using right. pressors.
We use norepinephrine these days to bring up a person's blood pressure when they're in septic shock.
Yep, absolutely. So, that's a recent change. We used to use dopamine before that.
Right. Why did we go away from dopamine, though?
Well, Mark, I was going to let you explain that so you could look smart.
From the way I understand it, what they found is your body is actually just converting dopamine into norepinephrine and using that.
So, well.
So, like when you're trying to buy a car, you skip the middleman.
Yeah. No, perfect. Perfect.
So, you also have like your cardiac drugs. These would be your nitros and your aspirins and your morphine or your fentanyls and stuff like that. Now, these are coming from different areas, fentanyl, morphine being an opiate.
Yep.
Narcan or aspirin not being an opiate.
Right.
But they can all be used for the same condition.
Nitro and aspirin.
Oh, what did I say?
Narcan and aspirin.
Oh, sorry. Nitro. Absolutely nitro on that. You also have your ACLS drugs.
Mm-hmm. ACLS, by the way, stands for Advanced Cardiac Life Support.
When your heart stops and we're shocking you, these are the algorithms that are standardized that we follow. So if you're in VFib or pulseless VTAC, you're going to follow this algorithm.
Right.
If they're bradycardic, you're going to follow. Bradycardic is a slow heartbeat.
Or tachycardic, which is a fast heartbeat.
Right. You're going to follow this rhythm. And this is the standard that we use. So everybody's on the same page when you're getting patient care. So whether you're in backwater somewhere, rural, or you're downtown major city, you should be getting the same standard of care.
Yeah, and in fact, where I really like it, though, is you get many jurisdictions have multiple agencies responding on scene. And what I really like about it is you'll get two different agencies that are on the same page. In fact, and this is actually a good point, when we're running Code 99s, you actually get a lot of, very recently, we had
Code
a very
99 is when a person has died and we're trying to restart their heart. It's a CPR-involved call.
And very recently, we had a call that ended up being a Narcan call, but we had a call where it started out as a Code 99, or allegedly, and when we got there, one of the family members was like, "What are you doing? You know, pick them up and go." You know, it's like, we're doing our job. One of the things that people need to realize is that when someone's not breathing and they don't have a pulse, we are doing the exact same thing they're going to receive in the ER.
Well, in our very first episode, you talked about how what we're doing replicates what they do in about the first 10 or 15 minutes in an emergency room.
Absolutely. So it's actually there are better outcomes for the patient if we stay on scene a little bit and work our magic.
Well, the last study I saw or heard about that's kind of coming down the pipeline is on cardiac arrest, where we would get the call initiated and get off scene. They're now advocating at least 30 minutes of working the patient on scene before you even think about moving that patient.
Absolutely. And that is going to be at odds with the public's perception of us.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, you mentioned Narcan, Chris.
Yes, I did. Narcan.
Why would you mention this drug?
So, Narcan's been in the news a lot lately. Narcan, or naloxone, is a...
Well, is that the same thing?
Yes, it is.
Well, why does it have two names, Chris?
Because one is a brand name and one is the proper name.
Well, why would they do that for Narcan? Why wouldn't they do that for all drugs?
They do it for a lot of them.
Really?
Yeah.
No, actually, they do.
Yeah.
So when you go to the store and you see Tylenol and you see acetaminophen...
Same thing.
Right. Or...
But one's made with care.
And or if you go to a different country, like in England, it's called paracetamol.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Right. Or you have a brand name, and I'm going to use a brand name here. I don't generally like to do this, but Bayer aspirin.
Yes.
For the longest time, and it probably is still this way in Canada, you don't call it aspirin, you just call it Bayer.
Oh, wow.
Because it's that prolific.
Yeah. Like Kleenex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. So Narcan has been around for as long as I've been on the job, 24 years, longer than that. And what is it, Chris?
It's a narcotics antagonist. So basically, when someone has a narcotic or an opiate overdose, and that's going to be heroin, oxycodone, most of your pain medicines are going to come from this family.
Vicodin.
When someone has too much of this, what it's going to cause is some of those medications bind to receptors in your brain that control breathing. It's going to slow down your breathing, and it's going to cause the classic overdose. And that's when you start seeing the paleness, the blue lips, no or a low respiratory rate, and agonal respirations where it's like they're snoring, low or no pulse is a possibility, and, of course, unconsciousness. And that's your typical overdose. What a narcotic antagonist like naloxone does is we give it IV or IM, which is through the muscle, or we spray it up the nose now as well.
Which is actually something the public is now able to do.
And what this does is it goes in there, it goes to those receptors, and it kicks out the drug, essentially, is what it does. And it is one of the cooler things you do as a paramedic. You will go on patients who just look, and in some cases are very, very close to
being. They're not breathing.
Yeah, and they look dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you go there, and it's like, okay, we check a few things. One of the big things that I will check is, along with history, check pupils. They have these pinpoint pupils. That's a telltale sign of a narcotic overdose. Small pupils, they're not breathing. We're going to breathe for them because that's the critical thing. But then we're going to get that naloxone on board, and they turn around like that.
Yeah.
They're back in action just like you and me. They usually vomit. My last guy vomited.
You haven't seen somebody vomit until they Narcan vomit.
Yeah, because it's just...
It is projectile vomiting.
Yeah. He was in the fetal position when he woke up, and he rolled over in the fetal position and proceeded to vomit aggressively, like 3 inches away from his face onto the carpet, onto which it almost looked... It looked like someone was welding with vomit, you know, like where it's just hitting and then like where you're welding and there's sparks flying up everywhere, but it was just vomit. Like, we got back.
Right.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's the reason they're doing this is that you're actually causing a form of withdrawal because they've gone from being excessively involved with the drug to probably not involved at all. You've completely killed their high, and just that sudden shift in the balance, which they need to, you know, you need to fix because they're not breathing properly. Well, that has shifted other things in their body. One of the ways they react is by vomiting a lot and very hard. We try not to do that. We don't want that to happen.
No.
Because usually if that happens, you get another side effect, and it's combativeness. They're going to come up fighting because you just took away their high.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things I do worry about with Narcan, especially being in the public realm as it is, and it's I'm not against it, but it's not a fix-all.
Right. Well, and to be, so let's touch on that a little bit. So one of the things, and I think, what are two places, Vermont and Ohio, I think are the two states that are really getting in front of this. Just mute, Justin. So Vermont and Ohio, I think are the two states that are really, really, really getting in front of this. And what they're doing is they are giving naloxone or Narcan to the public. To use and to help save lives, and it is controversial right now, and there's a few reasons why. So one of the things that Mark had mentioned is it's not a fix all. So the problem with Narcan is it temporarily cleans out these receptor sites. So if you have enough narcotics on board, and I've been on these patients, you give them the Narcan for them to wake up and they feel better, and they usually don't want to go to the hospital, but they really do need to.
Because in 10 or 15 minutes, they're probably going to be back in the same position.
Absolutely. And so what worries a lot of providers is that we're going to end up with Narcan out in the field and, in the possession of citizens. And they're going to be using it initially, thinking everything's hunky-dory. Okay, good. Bob's back. Let's leave.
Right.
Now Bob's alone, and now Bob's back in the situation he's in. And the second thing about that, too, is we're going to have fewer people calling 911. A lot of overdose, not a lot, but there are overdoses that we go on where they've been actually overdosed for quite some time because people don't want to call 911 if there's heroin in the house.
Well, yeah. I mean, these are a lot of the people that don't appreciate interaction with emergency services on the whole.
Yeah.
They're doing something that could get them in trouble legally. And if you call 911 and you say somebody's overdosed with a heroin... With the heroin. If somebody's overdosed on heroin or anything, if there's an overdose, for the safety of the crews, if nothing else, you're going to get a police response.
Yeah. Now, Ohio has actually taken a few steps, and this to me makes sense, but one of the, and I don't want to get too wrapped up in legal mumbo jumbo, but in late 2016, maybe August, they created their Good Samaritan law, but in there, there's specific language to protect someone who would call 911 for medical help for an overdose from prosecutions for small amounts. Now, obviously, they walk in there and you are a drug dealer and you have a large amount, you're in trouble.
You have a grow going in your back room. Now, the thing is about Narcan also, it only works for opiates. Opiates are derivative, or the initial derivatives were from the opium plant. So this is like heroin.
It's like a rhododendron, right?
Yeah, exactly. this is your heroin, this is your opium, this is your morphine, Demerol. These are all naturally occurring in the opium plant. Since then, they've synthesized these things, and you've got your fentanyl, your Dilaudids, your methadone.
Yeah.
Methadone, a lot of people remember, because it was thought to be the fix for heroin. And what they found out is it doesn't really fix a heroin addiction, it just shifts it to a methadone addiction.
Right.
And it's still used. And when it comes right down to it, people getting... non-professionally made, street-produced heroin, or made in a factory where it's under a controlled situation, methadone, obviously the methadone is much better.
Yeah, safer.
Yeah. Well, it's very common to have overdoses spike when you get new types of heroin in town, because you don't know the strength of it.
Yeah. And then one of the big things that we experienced in our area was methamphetamine was popular. And then legislation was passed which made methamphetamine more expensive. And so people who were heroin users, although the effects are different, substantially so, people who were heroin users who were on methamphetamine because the cost was lower, switched back to heroin.
Right.
Well, now it's a whole new ball game.
Well, have you heard of Crocodile?
No.
You have not?
I've not heard of Crocodile. Okay.
Disclaimer here.
Okay.
Do not go looking for pictures of Crocodile if you are easily disturbed by... subject matter that is really graphic.
Okay.
So this became big in the Soviet Union. It's called Crocodile because that's Russian for crocodile. Because one of the side effects of this drug is it makes your skin look like crocodile scales. So
what?
Heroin is very expensive in Russia.
Uh-huh.
Codeine is an over-the-counter drug. You do not need a prescription to get codeine.
In Russia?
In Russia. Oh. So...
Hey, comrade.
So, this is just so... Tylenol 3 is not a prescription medication.
Okay.
So, what they've done is they're taking this codeine and in a very crack-esque way, and the fact they're mixing it with common household chemicals to make... what is it? Hydromorphone, maybe?
Yeah, hydromorphone's Dilaudid.
They may be making... They're making a street version of heroin.
Wow.
That doesn't last as long. And because you're using bleach, gasoline, kerosene, stuff like that, it's not only bad for you, but it will actually cause skin to slough off your bones. And there are pictures on the internet of that where you can see the person's bone. And these people will get up and walk out of a hospital because they're so addicted to it because they've got to do it like 4 or 5 times a day.
Jeez.
That they will walk away from a hospital to go get more.
Drugs kill.
Yeah. So would Narcan be effective on this? Maybe. Why? Because they're changing the fundamental structure. We've come across just recently a new type of fentanyl that we may not carry enough Narcan on the rig to counteract because it's so strong.
Jesus.
So, you know, I mean, it's, we said at the beginning of the show that, you know, people find new and inventive ways to hurt themselves every day.
And unfortunately,
from what I was talking to a medic who rode with us, he's a pre-hire and he's from Illinois, and crocodiles showing up in Illinois and it's coming this way and it's nasty stuff.
Yeah, Jesus.
So anyway, not to end on a depressing note, but yeah, that's what we use Narcan for. And that's why it's become it's relatively benign. On the grand scheme of things, there's not many side effects. And it can save lives. But the problem is that if you save that life, they still need to be evaluated.
Yeah, and that is the worry, is that by having Narcan out in the street, is that we'll have people not getting evaluated.
Right.
So
you can wear off and you're back in the same spot. And if your buddies have gone off to continue partying and you stayed home,
yeah,
there may not be somebody there to call 911 when you're back in that position.
Absolutely. So, yeah, a lot of controversy over it. And it'd be interesting to see how that turns out. Because it's one of those things where, I mean, I do share that fear of people being left behind or not getting
this. As medics, we joke about stuff. We laugh about stuff. We laugh about our own ability to do stuff.
Yeah.
But we're in this job because we want to help people.
Yeah. And
we want the best for them.
And I worry about that from a public stance of it being a problem. But at the same time, I mean, if they do craft legislation around that helps encourage people to call 911 regardless when this stuff is used, then it might have a positive effect. But it does remain to be seen.
Yeah. Hopefully that's something that is taken in a positive light. And, you know, I don't want to get into a political rant here. So
yeah.
I think that's where I'm going to end up my discussion on this.
Yeah, I want to keep digging the hole. No, I'm just joking. I'm good. Good smattering of topics. That was actually a good range.
Yeah, you know, it's everything we do, we probably do for a reason.
Probably.
You know, I mean, we're not going to start an IV on you unless there's a reason for it.
Yeah.
We're not going to give you these medications or use a spine board or defibrillate you or cardiovert you without a good reason. So, just remember that things have changed. We're no longer just the ambulance drivers.
No, we're not.
We do that sometime of driving the ambulance, but
yeah,
we can do a lot more. These days, a lot of times, we are on the equivalent of an RN.
Very true.
So, anyway, this has been Medical Stuff. My name is...
Mark Frankham, right?
Yep, and you're Chris Finkston, and we are out of here.
Bye.
Toast.
Toast. Where the fuck is the stop button there?